Google learns how to say opt-in en français when it comes to the scanning of copyrighted books. Meanwhile, Barnes & Noble cracks open the legal books and cites the Tunney Act to label the proposed Department of Justice settlement with publishers in the Apple price-fixing case as not in the public interest. And among PW reviews, we've learned that Delia Ephron's newest, The Lion Is In, is a fun, refreshing, and incredibly touching tale of a trio of women at a ramshackle roadside diner. Welcome to Beyond the Book, everyone. My name is Chris Keneally, and every Friday we join the editors and reporters for Publishers Weekly for a look at the week ahead. And joining me in his New York office today is features editor Andrew Albanese. Andrew, welcome to Beyond the Book.
Hey, Chris. Nice to have you here.
Well, it's nice to be dropping by and see you. We saw you last week at Book Expo. We were all so busy we couldn't do much talking beyond what we had to do. But we're here to kind of catch up on things and not talk about BEA. But again, we're returning to the courtroom, developments in three cases. Let's start with the DOJ's price-fixing case.
Well, it's nice to be back, and I hope everyone out there had a great BEA, as I know we did here at PW. And yes, back to the courtroom. As you'll remember, in our last podcast, we talked about Penguin McMillan's rather forceful rejection of the DOJ's charges against them. Well, since then, we've had a few twists. The first is that Barnes & Noble has now weighed into the fray. Last week, they urged the court to reject a deal struck by three publishers, Simon & Schuster, HarperCollins, and Hachette, to settle the price-fixing charges against them by the Department of Justice. Now, like Penguin, the Penguin brief 2 weeks ago, the Barnes & Noble brief also makes for some fascinating reading. As you noted, they cite the Tunney Act, which requires a court to reject any proposed final judgment that is not in the public interest. The Tunney Act also advises courts to pay special attention to the potential of any remedy to inflict harm upon third parties. Well, BNN argues, the proposed settlement in this case is in fact not in the public interest because it would restore Amazon's place of dominance in the ebook market, and it would injure third parties like independent bookstores, authors, other publishers and consumers, and of course, Barnes & Noble. But the big news this week is that it's not just Barnes & Noble jumping in. You may recall that the Department of Justice settlement required a 60-day comment period to precede the settlement approval process. And beyond Barnes & Noble, there have been over 150 comments filed so far. And while I've not seen them all, I have seen some. And basically, these comments support publishers and urge that this settlement be rejected. In fact, they've received so many comments so far, the Department of Justice has asked the court for permission to make them available in digital only to avoid the cost of printing, which I think is kind of funny. But a few observations on this fine mess. First, I have to call out one of the commenters on the Publishers Weekly site who said basically, you know, hey, Department of Justice, if it's you and Amazon are the only people thinking that suing publishers over ebook prices is a good idea, maybe you should think again. You know, point taken there. But I've also been talking with some lawyers, and there's another side to this whole public comment mess. On one hand, I think publishers definitely appreciate this groundswell of support. It has to make them feel good. On the other hand, you have to wonder if rejecting this settlement is really what these publishers want. Remember, the settlement is only a 2-year sanction, and somewhere along the line, the attorneys at these publishers decided that they could live with this deal because in 2 years, it'd all be over. You know, ask yourself this question. Where do you think McMillan and Penguin are going to be in 2 years? McMillan and Penguin, of course, are fighting these charges in court. Now, remember, if the court does reject the DOJ settlement, these price-fixing charges don't just go away. There's still a lot of heavy lifting to do before that could happen. Could the charges be dropped? It's possible, but I wouldn't say likely. The point being, you know, we don't know what a rejection of this DOJ settlement would actually mean. Would it mean litigation? Probably. Possibly. A new settlement that could potentially be worse for publishers? Maybe. We just don't know. And remember, in addition to the DOJ, we also have a state-level class action and a consumer class action. So while publishing hearts probably love the idea of being heroically defended, publishing minds kind of like the idea of this settlement, because a settlement offers certainty. On one hand, you know, if this settlement is rejected, you have uncertainty and potentially worse. So I would venture to say that the book business is actually living through an example of what happens when settlements fail right now with the failed Google settlement.
Well, that's a great transition because, as you mentioned, there was a proposed settlement in the Google Books case a couple of years ago that was ultimately rejected by Judge Chin, and now people are heading back into his courtroom, and it looks like things are moving forward there. What's the latest?
So a few things have happened since we last spoke. First, by now, probably everyone knows that Judge Chin did indeed certify the Authors Guild as an associational plaintiff, meaning that we are on track to have the big, juicy, fair use trial we all envisioned back when the suits were first filed in 2005, and it's going to be a class action. That trial could now begin as early as September. Now, publishers and Google are said to be working on another settlement of their own, supposedly, but I think it's going to be really worth watching to see whether that deal now gets done before oral arguments in the Authors Guild case. We also have a bit of housekeeping news to report that was kind of lost in the BEA madness. But motions for summary judgment in this case, the Authors Guild case, were expected to be delivered this week on June 14th. But as of June 1, that date has now been extended. So we're not going to see those filings until June 26th. And those filings, I'll remind you, are going to be pretty huge. They will address the real heart of this matter, whether or not Google's industrial-scale scanning and snippet of displays is protected by fair use.
I like that, industrial-scale scanning. But on another front for Google, with publishers and authors, they have come to an agreement, a sort of twist on the case coming from France.
That's exactly right. This week, Google and French publishers and authors groups announced that they had settled the litigation over there, over the search program. Notably, that settlement is an opt-in deal. That means that copyright holders will now decide what Google can scan and what they can display, and of course, what they're going to be able to sell under this deal. So how much can we read into that settlement for the U.S.? Very little. You know, as you know well, Chris, copyright law is quite different in France, and Google was facing significant legal, cultural, and government headwinds there. Nevertheless, I do think this decision reflects a desire to move on by Google, especially as it gets ready to launch Google Play in Europe, and to get away from this, you know, these litigations. Frankly, I'd say it probably makes some sense for them to do that in the U.S. too. By now, we've seen that the disaster that publishers predicted would happen in 2005, you know, hasn't happened. The ebook market, meanwhile, has matured greatly. So if Google was to say, okay, this is an opt-in program, you can turn on these books for sale, most people who had books scanned by Google would probably opt into the program and start selling them. I mean, why not, right? Do we really want a potentially messy fair use ruling that either side could lose? Or do we want more books in Google Play and a chance for authors and publishers to give new life to books that are long dead on their backlist? Now, there are downsides to that, of course. This deal would do nothing for orphan works, for example. But that's an issue for another day.
And as Judge Chin said, probably an issue for Congress. Finally, you're headed out back to the airport next week, and where off to?
We'll be off to Anaheim for the American Library Association annual conference. It's going to be another super busy show. They've got a great lineup of authors this year. You should check that out on the Publishers Weekly website. We have a whole package about ALA this year. So if you're going, do check that out. And the highlight for me is going to be the awarding of the first ever Carnegie Medals for adult fiction and nonfiction. So I look forward to filling you in on that next week from Anaheim.
We'll be talking to you then from the ALA conference. Andrew Albanese, PW's Features Editor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And joining us on the line, as she usually does with the review of the week's reviews, is Rose Fox, who blogs at Genreville. Rose, welcome back.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Well, it's good to have you join us again. We all had a week off at BEA, but we're really back in business, and you've got a number of reviews this week. We'll start off with some new books from writers who had smash debuts in fiction.
Yes. You may remember Sheldon Edwards' The Little Book. It took him 3 decades to write and went on to be a sensation. It only took him 4 more years to write The Lost Prince, which is his sprawling new novel and follow-up to his debut. And our reviewer says it's just as much fun. You've probably also heard of a little book called Trainspotting by Irvine Welsh. Well, Welsh is back with Skag Boys. This is a prequel to Trainspotting, set in Edinburgh, and all the familiar players are back. And as with much of Welsh's work, this one unfolds mostly in his signature dialect and is full of disturbing sex, explosive violence, and a general feeling of impending doom. There's also a starred review of Juno Diaz's new short story collection, This Is How You Lose Her, and this is his first book since he won the Pulitzer with The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. Our reviewer says it's raw, honest, and utterly addictive. We also have a Q&A in fiction this week. Maria Semple, who's the author of Where'd You Go, Bernadette, she says that she pulled the book out of her own life when she was in a miserable, self-pitying, toxic funk, and the comedy writer in her recognized that it was funny. Mystery and thriller, Danish author Jussi Adler-Olsen's The Absent One is his second Department Q novel, in which a Copenhagen detective superintendent looks into a case supposedly solved years before, the murder of a teenage brother and sister. And it turns out that a fellow student of the victims who confessed and went to prison may have been protecting others. We also review Louise Penny's The Beautiful Mystery. This is her eighth Chief Inspector Gamache novel, in which the Quebec policeman looks into the murder of an isolated monastery's choir master. The Q&A is with Marco Vici, author of Death in August, set in 1963 Florence, and introducing Inspector Bordelli. And when we asked him why he gave his hero that name, which means brothels, Vici replied, "It's not a real surname, and in some sense it alludes a little to the inspector's character, not because of any passion for brothels, but just because of his disorderly life."
I like that. And Rose, you blog about science fiction, fantasy, and horror titles on Genreville, and there's a couple of interesting points you want to make in that genre area this week.
Yeah, we have a great Q&A with Jim Hines. I love Jim Hines. He's also a blogger, and he writes very eloquently about topics like sexism and the way that women are viewed and in the genre, both within books and as writers and participants in science fiction fandom. And he recently complained that no one ever asks him, why did you choose to make your protagonist a straight man? Because that's, of course, the default. We sort of naturally assume that everybody is a straight man unless proven otherwise. So we asked him, why did you choose to make your protagonist a straight man? And he says, well, now I can never again say that nobody has asked me that. But of course, to find out the answer, you'll have to read the Q&A. We also review At the Mouth of the River of Bees by Kidge Johnson. This is her first collection of short fiction, which is kind of amazing because she keeps getting awards and nominations for it. She covers strange, beautiful, and occasionally disturbing territory. And our reviewer says that some of them take place in mythical Japan, some in familiar contemporary settings, but they are sometimes off-putting, sometimes funny, and always thought-provoking. We also review The Constantine Affliction by T. Aaron Payton. This is a 19th century London steampunk novel in which a disease is spreading that either kills its victims or transforms them into the opposite sex. And again, this was an attempt to deal with sexism. The creator of this strange illness felt it was unfair that men and women were treated differently. And so he decided to create this mechanism for transforming one into another. But of course, everybody is terrified of it in the very gendered, restricted Victorian London culture. So it's an interesting bit of social commentary in there, in addition to being a steampunk murder mystery.
Well, a fascinating conceit. And steampunk travels into romance this week.
Yeah, I've been seeing a lot of romance authors kind of dipping their toes in, and one of them is Mary Wine. She's very well known for doing romances about Highlanders or set in Regency England. This is her first steampunk novel, A Lady Can Never Be Too Curious. And our reviewer says it fuses steamy sexual tension and secret societies when a young science-minded woman crashes a meeting of a secret society and learns that she can manipulate the magical crystals that they use. Also in romance, we have Return of the Viscount by Gail Callan. I love this story. The idea is that there's a young woman who wants to be independent but knows that she must be married, and so she proposes marriage to one of her father's old army buddies, figuring that he's off on permanent assignment to India. She'll never see him, and then eventually he'll die of old age and she can be a respectable widow. But then he's injured and he comes home and finds out that the mail order groom, essentially, is actually the strapping young man. And of course, he thought he was marrying some desperately frumpy woman who couldn't get a husband any either way, and she turns out to be quite gorgeous. So this is an unusual romance setup in the Regency romance world.
I like that one, too. Sounds intriguing. In comics, what have we got?
We've got a starred review of Journalism by Joe Sacco. These are short pieces that are, it acts sort of as a companion to his book-length works, which, you know, books like Footnotes in Gaza. And he basically lays out his goals as a comics journalist. So he has his ethical stances and his political stances that he expresses in these comics about modern day politics and events. And he's traveled to Hebron, Iraq, India, or returned to his native Malta. But he's still always, wherever he is, he digs up these dramatic individual stories that are illustrative of larger social or political problems. And you know, it's all just superb work. A reviewer says it's a powerful record of voices that would otherwise have gone largely unheard. Another unheard voice pops up in nonfiction. This is Megrahi, You Are My Jury, The Lockerbie Evidence by John Ashton. I'm sure you've heard of Al Megrahi, the convicted Lockerbie bomber who died earlier this year of cancer. And this is his attempt and Ashton's attempt to lay out the case for his innocence and to posit that there were other people behind the bombing that killed a number of people in an airplane explosion. And Megrahi himself writes several sections that provide insight into his state of mind and show him to be an intelligent, conscientious man concerned above all with the well-being of his family. In fact, he dropped his final appeal saying that he faced an appalling choice to die in prison in the hope of being cleared posthumously or to die at home still bearing the weight of my conviction. And he says, for my family's sake, I decided I must choose the latter. So this is a very powerful and interesting book, though clearly with a partisan bias. And we also review In Fire in the Ashes, 25 Years Among the Poorest Children in America. Jonathan Kozol, who wrote The Shame of the Nation, again traces the workings of savage inequalities, this time on a generational scale. And it's an engrossing chronicle of lives blighted and redeemed. Our reviewer says he works like a latter-day Dickens, but without the melodrama. And in the expansive, nuanced biography On a Farther Shore, The Life and Legacy of Rachel Carson, William Sauder portrays Carson as a woman passionate in friendship, poetic and innovative in her books about the sea, and gentle but ambitious. And you probably may have heard of Rachel Carson as the author of Silent Spring, which sort of kicked off the environmentalist movement. And if you can believe it, that was in 1962, 50 years ago. So this is a very timely biography of Carson and the writers who influenced her, as well as the political situations that informed her writing about the environment. And we have a Q&A with Seth Rosenfield, who's the author of Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power.
Well, you know, you mentioned the 50th anniversary of Silent Spring, Rosen, and you also, previous to that, were talking about Jonathan Kozol. And his very first book, as I recall, was called Death at an Early Age, came out in the mid-60s, and it was an examination of the Boston public schools, and it brought to light a number of inequalities there. So he is somebody else who's also been at work for many, many years, very much a crusader through his writing. What have we got in Children's Religion and Spirituality this week?
The children's section this week does have a religion spirituality subsection, one of the more interesting titles in there that I found is Be Like God, God's To-Do List for Kids. And this is a very readable and inspiring volume that teaches what it means to be a partner with God. So he describes 10 actions that he calls superpowers that turn individuals into divine helpers. So the superpowers are things like create or bless or comfort or forgive, and each one is illustrated with delightful stories explaining what they're about and then concluding with to-do lists. In our online annex this week, we have Delia Efron's newest, The Lion Is In, which follows a trio of women running from the past and looking to rebuild their lives, starting with waitressing jobs at a ramshackle roadside diner. Fans of Efron and newcomers alike will find plenty to enjoy in this fun, refreshing, and incredibly touching read. And William Hertzberg exhaustively details the life and times of Richard Brautigan in Jubilee Hitchhiker, an ambitious study in excess and a thorough portrait of the eccentric man behind trout fishing in America.
And finally this week, Rose, the pick of the week is a family story that really has taken a number of twists.
Yeah, this is Marco Roth's debut memoir, and he's a literary critic, but he turns to his own life, mining the silence and shame he experienced growing up on Central Park West in the 1980s and 90s as his father died of AIDS, and he was never allowed to tell anyone the cause of his father's illness and death because he was told it had resulted from a freak needle accident with an infected patient. But that may not actually have been the case. So he was really haunted by his own sense of inadequacy, his inability to save his father, and just a real story of torment and also some family drama.
Well, indeed. And thank you for all of those stories, Rose Fox from PW, and she blogs at Jean McVille. Always nice to have you join us.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Chris. I'll talk to you again next week.
Indeed. And we should tell everybody that Copyright Clearance Center produces Beyond the Book, the weekly podcast series. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest broker of copyrighted materials in text, images, and a variety of other materials, including television, news, films, and photography of all kinds. We also are online at Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. Jeremy Briskey is our engineer from Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For everybody at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.